Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Chesley Christ was an American television correspondent, a model. She was a beauty pageant title holder. In fact, she was crowned Miss USA in 2019. She was 30 years old, and last month, Christ died on January 30th after jumping to her death from the Orion, which is a 60-story high-rise apartment building in Midtown Manhattan. Her mother recently came out, April Simpkins, and said that her daughter suffered from what's called high-functioning depression. What is high-functioning depression? It's something that actually many people struggle with. Maybe they don't identify it. Maybe they don't realize it, or maybe they don't want to talk about it. But watching a beautiful young woman with everything you could want in life at her fingertips, she was unhappy. There were demons. There were things she was dealing with. And that's why we wanted to open up the conversation with an expert this morning. And joining me this morning, very happy to have on the show, Dr. Andre Newfield with St. Vincent's Medical Center, Chair of Psychiatry, to explain, first of all, what is high-functioning depression? Good morning, Dr. Newfield. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Melissa. Pleasure to be with you, unfortunately, on this tough topic, but it's great that you're opening it up to talk about it.
I appreciate that. I mean, I'm familiar with high-functioning depression because I have family members who have high-functioning depression. But for many people, they may have never heard of that term before. What is it?
So it's not an official diagnosis. This is something that falls under the heading of major depressive disorder. Basically, it's you know, sort of showing two sides of a coin for a person that is suffering to some degree, but able to manage, you know, their daily lives in a really successful way that helps mask the problem from people around them. And, you know, it's great that they have the foundation to be able to be as successful as they are, but the concern is what's keeping them from allowing people in or dealing with their problems in a more public way. And so having a discussion like this today where we're sort of helping to take the mask off and help people understand, you know, what people are going through, even if they're not, you know, showing the typical signs of a person who's depressed, is really, really important and helpful.
In your professional opinion, Dr. Newfield, how do you even have high-functioning depression? Like, if you are struggling to the point that Chesley was struggling, I mean, to the point that she took her own life, how do you even manage to have this other side of you, almost like a split personality almost? And I don't, yeah. I'm not attacking her whatsoever. It breaks my heart. But like, how do you even have the energy to be as successful as she was, but then also be battling this other side of you that is clearly taking you down?
Well, many mental health diagnoses, particularly those in the mood disorder realm, which depression is in, are episodic. And so you can have periods of doing really, really well where you yourself feel great and you yourself feel that, you know, there's no problem. And all the more possible if somebody is being treated and taking medication that's helping them or going to therapy. And there are times when people, you know, maybe to some degree fall off the wagon a little bit, or because stressors in their lives are increasing to a point that it becomes overwhelming, that they start to decompensate and have a depressive episode or a mood episode other than depression. And, you know, that's when, you know, maybe it's more apparent, or, you know, they take a leave of absence from work. And because we protect people's health information, you know, they don't necessarily want to go around advertising how they're suffering. And, you know, people don't know what they're experiencing. They only see those positive times and maybe not those other times. Furthermore, you know, there may be this disconnect between what somebody's revealing in terms of, you know, what they're experiencing, you know, in their mood or what they're coping with in terms of their stressors that they don't necessarily want to share. So they may be suffering in real time and still exuding some sort of a facade that you know, doesn't reveal that.
We're talking to Dr. Newfield this morning, and we're diving into high-functioning depression, which if you are late to the conversation, Dr. Newfield said it's not like that's a diagnosis, but it's a type of depression that some people go through. And what it basically means is when you can balance a work life, a social life, without kind of people knowing you're struggling inside. It's sort of a mask. It's a way for you to hide what you're dealing with. And Dr. Newfield, that's my next concern. I look at this mom. I can't even imagine having such a successful daughter and knowing she's struggling, but to the point that she took her own life. I mean, I can't imagine what this mom felt the next day saying, yeah, she had high-functioning depression. Now, of course, without knowing anything about this family, and who cares to judge at this point, but for people at home, if they have someone they know, they love, they cherish, who seems like from time to time they may be in a dark place or they kind of retreat from the family, or like, are there things you should be looking at beyond just, oh, they have some mood swings or, oh, they have some things they're dealing with? Like, how do you address or figure out if someone is like a high functioning having depression? How do you even determine that before, God forbid, they take their own life or they do something dangerous?
I think that's sort of the crux of the question here. And you want to do all you can to help somebody open up and feel comfortable to share things. And, you know, who knows if Miss Chris, you know, had suicide attempts before or things like that. But, you know, for people that do, you know, the risk goes up. And so you want to look at what's somebody's history and, you know, how bad have things been at their worst, so that you have some sort of, you know, level of comparison. And if it's, you know, necessitating hospitalization at a certain point, or if it's necessitating consistent treatment, or if somebody's had suicidal thoughts or suicide attempts, then you want to, you know, help them feel comfortable that in moments where, you know, maybe the alerts are going off that things are getting worse, that they're able to share that and that there are some plans in place for what are we going to do when, you know, things start to get worse? Are we going to, you know, schedule a more rapid appointment with your providers? If you've fallen out of treatment, how are we going to get you back into treatment? And sort of providing the message that, you know, it might be really, really tough for somebody that's successful to imagine, well, things are getting worse and now I have to take the time to address it and I have to step back from all of those other things that are part of my identity and making me so successful. So, you know, constructing a plan and safeguards and sort of realizing, you know, what is the worst potential and how are we going to address it when the alarms start going off that things are not headed in the right direction?
We've been talking about high-functioning depression, what it really is, and I wanted to connect that to mental health. You know, Dr. Newfield, you know this very well. We are dealing with a mental health crisis, of course, 2 years after COVID. Do you fear that not just kids, but also adults, people in isolation, people who haven't been in their workplaces, people who haven't felt like they're in school, maybe they went through COVID, they lost someone to COVID, lost a job to COVID, whatever it may be. Do you fear there are a big bump up in high-functioning depression cases in Connecticut?
You know, I think it's hard to say whether it's high-functioning or not. I think as an absolute, we're seeing an increase in the numbers of mental health patients that are seeking help. And, you know, is it in part that, you know, some of the stigma has been removed because everybody feels like everybody's suffering and therefore now it's
like
a lot more acceptable to come for help? Or in part, you know, are a lot of the things that have been going on, the isolation, as you pointed out, the change in people's routines, you know, in itself causing mental health problems. I think there's no doubt in that. But I'd say that, you know, the high functioning depression, is probably, you know, increasing in proportion with, you know, the other mental health issues and particularly the rise in depression. So as the rise in depression goes, most likely the rise in high functioning depression is going to increase as well.
What do you suggest parents especially do if they feel their kids might be going down that path? Because the thing is we also live in a society right now, Dr. Newfield, which I'm sure you know, where, you know, parents fear they don't want to introduce a thought to their kids either. They don't want to, you know, they don't want to say like, are you depressed? Are you going through a hard time? You know, what's going on? Is this really serious? Or are you just in a funk? I mean, it's a hard conversation to have, and it's a weird place for parents to be. And you never know. Kids are very impressionable. So especially if you've got younger kids, even middle school or high schoolers, what do you suggest parents do? Things that they should pick up on, maybe?
So I'd say for the parent that's afraid of introducing something that would cause a problem, for them to know that with the increasing acceptance and decreasing stigma of mental health, that these things are being discussed in schools at a quite regular frequency, and that, you know, their friends are talking about it as well. And so I'd be surprised if there are any kids out there in school that, you know, don't have a friend who's talking about anxiety or depression to begin with. So as for the fear that you're going to bring it up and introduce it and cause a problem, that's probably pretty low. And, you know, as we start out training in psychiatry, we learn one of the first questions you have to ask is, you know, are you having thoughts of hurting yourself or ending your life? And you have to understand that that's not putting the thought in somebody's head. So being comfortable talking about things is the first step. And, you know, not making excuses for this is going to be a problem for them, that way I'm not going to talk about it. Let's get comfortable ourselves with talking about it. And, you know, just starting there is really the first step for parents. But, you know, once you've started to talk about it, or you know, even if you don't know how to talk about it, making sure that their pediatrician gets clued into the fact, you know, and is aware and can help you sort out, you know, what's a real problem that we have to address here, or what is it, you know, just part of normal, you know, teenage angst or something along those lines. It's really tough as a parent to sort of accept that your child might have a problem like this. Mm-hmm. But if you bury your head in the sand and you don't address it, you know, that's not doing any good.
Yeah. No, I couldn't agree with you more, Dr. Newfield. I don't think any parent wants to know that their child is unhappy or that they're struggling. But you certainly don't want to be like Chesley Christ's family. You don't want to be.
Yeah,
on that
and end, you don't want to, you know, you feel guilty probably, you know, what did I do or what didn't
this?
I do
yeah.
in order to get my child to this point.
Mm-hmm.
But if you continue not addressing it, you know, then there's maybe something to be guilty about. If you're talking about it and trying everything you can to address it, that's the best that you can do.
Dr. Newfield, the chair of psychiatry at St. Vincent's Medical Center, thank you so much for having this conversation with us on the air. I really appreciate it.
And thank you for introducing the issue. It's really important to talk about it, and I admire people that are doing so. So thank you so much.
No, it's not a problem. You're welcome back anytime. If we have other topics to chat about, we'd love to have you back on the show. Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa. Have a great day.
You too.
The Park City is your city. Melissa in the Morning finds out what's happening in Bridgeport now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Welcoming back to the show this morning, the Superintendent of Schools, Michael Testani. Good morning, Mr. Testani. Thank you so much for being back. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I'm well. How are you?
Yeah, of course. I'm doing fine. Thank you so much. It's been a pretty hectic week. You know, the governor decides to say, hey, we're going to drop the mask mandate by the end of February. And of course, every school district is reacting. So I wanted to just set the record, you know, straight and I guess hear from you directly, because it really comes down to you working with the mayor's office, of course. What is sort of your feel on the mask mandate with schools? What is your initial approach, you think?
Well, I mean, I think obviously we're seeing some really good numbers statewide when it comes to COVID positivity rates and things coming, you know, way down since the spike of Omicron right after the holiday. So that's encouraging. I know that the governor did put this in effect or is lifting it at the end of this month. So a couple more weeks, which will give it a little bit more time to see the numbers, I'm sure, continue to go down. I have some mixed emotions. I think it's kind of an awkward time of the school year. But at the same time, you know, I think that we need to start planning for, a return to, pre-pandemic, what school was like for kids.
I mean, the only thing that's interesting, well, there's a lot of things that are interesting about it, but with Bridgeport or places like Stamford or New Haven, what's hard is you guys have a citywide mask mandate. So that's challenging, too. I would think you have to work directly with the city on deciding, well, how do you tell kids they don't have to wear a mask, but then as soon as they go, you know, to the YMCA, for example, they got to go back to wearing a mask. If they want to go into any public building, you go back to wearing masks. Like, is that something I'm sure you guys are already in discussion about?
Yes. So we've started to have those discussions. I think, just like other towns around us, there's probably a hope that the mask mandate in the city is lifted as well. And I'm sure we're starting to lean toward that goal is, here in Bridgeport, Stamford, Norwalk. But I think we need to all be on the same page because it's, if we're not in unison, it creates a little bit more chaos. Why is this school district or why is this town? It just makes the narrative a little bit harder to speak on.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to the superintendent of schools in Bridgeport, Michael Testani. Superintendent Testani, what's interesting is you've got parents all across Connecticut. I'm not specifically speaking on Bridgeport per se, but you can certainly comment on it. Parents want their kids unmasked. Not all, but the majority want their kids unmasked. And then on the other side of things, you've got teachers who are like, listen, I don't feel comfortable. I want to open more windows. I want recess to be back outdoors. Like, I want to feel better. We just got over Omicron a couple of weeks ago. And I would love to know from, like, your professional opinion and what you're hearing from parents and teachers, what is sort of your thought on it?
Well, I mean, I think there everyone has different feelings on this. I think it's also, how the pandemic has maybe impacted them or their family directly that's causing folks to have some anxiety. Obviously, the news doesn't help us when cases do start to increase. But I do understand people's frustration, and I do understand that there are families that want their children unmasked. So, we have to be respectful. And I think that's why it's probably going to lean at some point when we get there that masks are going to be okay for those folks who want to continue to wear a mask. We shouldn't treat them any differently. But at the same time, we're going to have to probably at some point respect those folks that want to take their mask off and just go back to a life pre-pandemic.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about mental health, if you don't mind, while I have you on the phone here, Superintendent Testani. There was a recent report earlier this month. I was reading it, I think, in the Connecticut Post. The Connecticut's Department of Public Health deployed a task force to look at mental health resources in schools. And they prioritized 157 schools most in need of more mental health resources. And it looked like Bridgeport was near the top of the list. It wasn't number one, but it was number two, tied with New Haven, with over 20 schools that lacked enough mental health resources. What do you say to that, and what's being done to better address it?
Well, we've begun to try to employ more school counselors this year with the help of federal funding, more school social workers. We're working with some outside providers as well at about 16 of our schools to try to provide more mental health services to kids. This was a problem pre-pandemic. A lot of our kids have experienced trauma, at a young age, which is unfortunate, and it's not fair to them. And we need to be there to help support them as they go through life. It would be great that we can continue to provide these services once federal dollars do expire. And that's going to take a lot of help from federal, state, and local municipalities to be able to provide these services for the long term, because this isn't going to be a quick fix.
Mm-hmm. I mean, were you shocked to see that Bridgeport was one of the standout places that had the most schools struggling with this?
Absolutely not. I mean, I've been here in the district over 25 years. I've lived and born and raised here in Bridgeport. kids have experienced and been, you know, seen things, you know, that have been traumatic in their lives and that no child should have to experience. But unfortunately, that is the case. And we need to be able to provide the care and support in the public schools to help them be successful in life.
Well, and it was interesting, too, because yesterday when the governor had said, or a couple days ago when he had, you know, given his idea of what we should do with, like, gun control and things like that, one of the biggest things he wanted to invest in with this second year of the budget was he wants to get more cops across Connecticut. And I don't entirely disagree with it, but it's interesting because teachers and many other organizations were like, forget more cops. We need more mental health services. Let's dump more money into getting more counselors, like you had mentioned, you know, and things like that. Do you agree? Do you feel like we should be putting more focus, especially because Bridgeport is being eyed in this report? Do you feel like we are doing enough as a state to invest in mental health services for our kids, for our schools, and to get those the counselors, for example, or that guidance that we really need?
No, I don't think we're doing enough. I think we need to do a heck of a lot more. And that's going to take a tremendous investment from all stakeholders in being able to provide support for kids. The pandemic has exacerbated that. It is no fault of their own. These are children and young teens that need support. If we don't invest in that now, we're going to invest in other services later on that are going to be a lot more expensive to the budget. So I think we need to start carving out the monies. Have conversations with folks like myself, superintendents across the state, because this is not isolated to just big cities. This is happening across the state in all school districts.
Superintendent of Bridgeport Schools, Michael Testani, thank you so much for giving us a little bit of time this morning. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
All right. Talk to you soon. Some pretty big news this year, actually. Nutmeg Big Brothers Big Sisters and Big Brothers Big Sisters of Southwestern Connecticut, which are two longstanding Connecticut youth mentoring organizations, announced that they have merged to create what is now called Big Brothers Big Sisters of Connecticut. This new organization is planning to create more mentoring matches than ever before between adult volunteers and children ages 5 through their young adulthood in communities across our state. We have had on the show before a couple of times Ellen Tracy, who was the executive director of Big Brothers Big Sisters of Southwestern Connecticut. In fact, since 2002, she is now taking on a bigger role as director of advancement at Big Brothers Big Sisters of Connecticut. And this morning, I'm very happy to have on the show the president and CEO of Big Brothers Big Sisters of Connecticut, Andy Fleischman. Good morning, Andy. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. I mean, why decide to merge? What was the thinking behind this?
You know, the central motivation is simple. We want to figure out how to reach more kids in Connecticut. And as a unified statewide organization, we think we're going to have efficiencies and economies of scale that allow us to reach more kids, especially in your area, Bridgeport, New Haven, Stamford, Norwalk. There are tremendous needs, and we think we'll be able to match more kids.
So that was going to be my question. So because you're taking two really big organizations, there's still going to be locations right here in Fairfield and New Haven County?
Yeah. So first, let me make it clear that a lot of our people have been working remotely during the pandemic. We don't really need an office to do our work because so many of our mentoring matches are community-based matches where, say, Melissa, if you raise your hand to become a big sister and we have a girl in your area who we think would be a good match for you. You know, we have someone who's coming out to the child's home and bringing you there and introducing you to. So we don't really use our offices all that much. But yes, we still have an office in Bridgeport, Connecticut, which we plan to maintain.
Okay. And tell me what the merger is going to mean as far as like how many municipalities will it now serve? Because before, obviously, it reached a lot. I mean, as I mentioned, we have the one in Bridgeport on Fairfield Avenue, but and that serviced a lot of Fairfield County. But how many municipalities now are you guys partnered with this merger?
So there are 169 municipalities in the state of Connecticut. And with this merger, our organization now covers all of them.
You're kidding. So everyone's covered.
No.
Wow.
Yeah. So, if, you know, wherever your listener may be sitting, if they know, say, of a of a family where there's a child who is just not getting the adult time and attention that they think the child would most benefit from, they can contact us, and we'll do what we can to get that child matched with a mentor.
That is so cool. We're talking this morning with Annie Fleischman, a huge announcement that two very longstanding Connecticut youth mentoring organizations, very similar in nature, Nutmeg Big Brothers Big Sisters, and then Big Brothers Big Sisters of Southwestern Connecticut, have decided to become one. It is now Big Brothers Big Sisters of Connecticut, all one big happy family. They're going to serve all 169 municipalities, which is incredible. So, of course, the question here, Andy, is how do people get involved? How does it work?
So if you're interested in becoming a volunteer mentor, and we encourage that, especially we're looking for men from diverse backgrounds. Whenever we put out a call for mentors, we tend to get more women than men who show up. And we have, you know, very diverse kids who are pretty much 50-50 male, female. So this is a particular outreach to men from diverse backgrounds. But whoever you are, if you want to volunteer, basically you can reach us most easily probably through our website, which is ctbigs.org, connecticutbigs.org. There's a volunteer button, and you click there. When you enroll yourself, we will go ahead and interview you, ask you for reference checks, and assuming you pass the audition, We train you. We give you a couple hours of training to give you a sense of what mentoring is, what it's not. And then we do our best to match you with a young person who has similar interests and style, so that we create what we hope will be a good match. And we ask you to commit to being in the program for at least 1 year, because all the studies show that 1 year of a positive mentoring match relationship changes the trajectory of a child's life forever. So we ask the child and family and mentor to commit to 1 year. And most of our matches last far longer than that. Our average match length is over 3 years. And, you know, we have some matches that wash out quickly because of a parent or a mentor moving. So the modal match length is far longer than that. So once people get to know each other, you know, once a child and a mentor really have spent time together, they typically, you know, want to stay connected for a long, long time.
So what does that look like? Could you give us an example, Andy Fleischman? Like, what does it look like if I were a volunteer and I get matched with a child? Like, what does that mean? Does that mean twice a week I am meeting after school? Like, what does that look like? What does a volunteer opportunity look like for someone? Just as an example.
Great question. So we ask folks to commit to 6 to 10 hours per month of mentoring. And so that really means getting together basically once a week for, you know, 90 minutes or a couple hours, going out together to see a movie, to have a meal, to go to a museum, to go to a library, a zoo. But most importantly, spending the quality time where you're doing things together and talking, and a child is getting a chance to share and to know that the focus is on them. So that's how it works in community-based mentoring. We also have school or site-based mentoring that happens, as the name implies, at a school or a workplace or some other spot. And that typically is once per week at lunchtime or after school for about 90 minutes. But either way, it's all about the one-to-one time with a child who will benefit from the attention and care.
We're chatting this morning with Andy Fleischman, who is the CEO and president of Big Brothers Big Sisters of Connecticut. And here's my question for you, Andy. You had said earlier in the interview that you guys are looking for people with diverse backgrounds. And I could tell you right now, we've got listeners who are going, well, I'm not special. I have nothing to offer. I have no diverse background. I had a mother and a father. I grew up. I went to school. I went to my job, and that was it. And I guess what I want to, listeners to take away is, you know, when you say diverse backgrounds, of course, you know, if you can get people who are maybe of different culture or maybe from a different state or you know, whatever it may be, of course. But wouldn't you argue, Andy, that really the bigger thing here is everybody has a story. Everyone can relate to somebody, and you kind of vet that out in the process when they apply. I would imagine you guys just want people essentially who just want to love on people, right? I mean, isn't that really the goal here?
Yeah. Thank you, Melissa. That's a really great way to say it. Yeah. The single most important criterion that we always look for is that someone is ready to devote time and attention to a child who needs it. And having that readiness in your heart to give of yourself for a young person who really benefits just from someone sitting there for them, ready to listen, ready to be supportive. That is the most important thing. I mentioned diversity because we have incredibly diverse kids, a lot of kids whose backgrounds are Latinx, a lot of kids who are Black or West Indian. And we do have families who will sometimes say, you know, I'm a proud Puerto Rican and I'd like my child to have a strong Puerto Rican role model.
I see what you're saying.
And so
we like to have
diversity that reflects the demography of the kids we serve. But your point is very well taken. The most important thing is, you know, do you care about children? Are you ready to make sure that this child who you're matched with knows that they're important?
And honestly, you bring up a great point too, though, Andy. Like, you never know. So maybe, you know, maybe you're not African American. Like, maybe you are Caucasian, and you're thinking to yourself, okay, well then they don't really need me. But you know, I would argue that if you, let's just say, for example, let's say you grew up in Bridgeport and you went to, you know, like a city school, or you grew up in New York City, or you grew up in like Chicago, and you know, and you have, you know, a lot of friends who are African American, and you learn so much from like your childhood, and so maybe you don't look like the child that you are mentoring, but you can at least maybe want to hear them out, or maybe you know of a friend. That's the thing too, is like, you could, you know, you could say, hey, I want to sign up, and you get a great match, but then from the program you fall in love with it, and you have a friend that you grew up with, and you're like, hey, you'd be great for this program. You know, like, you could find connections to other people and bring that diversity as well. I think there's a lot of opportunity there to be able to help the program out. I really do think that.
That is very accurate. And, you know, as you're talking about that, it reminds me of a friend of mine who was born and raised in Enfield, Connecticut, and he signed up for the program, and the young boy who we matched him with had immigrated from Haiti. And
wow.
He came to me and he was like, you know, I don't really know that much about Haiti, and I'm a white guy, and you know, I don't know if I'm right for this. And I said, Dave, you're an extremely thoughtful person, an empathetic person, and I think you'd be great if you're up for it. And so he gave the thumbs up to the match, and he was incredibly helpful to his little brother. And, you know, they came from different backgrounds and so forth. But the fact that Dave is such a good person who also knows a lot about what it is to live in the state of Connecticut, he was an incredibly positive, powerful influence on that young man.
I think that's really cool. I think it's neat. And I know, like, my own husband, when we lived in Vermont, we had the conversation where he's like, I don't know what I could give to any. I have nothing to give to somebody. And I sat there and I'm like, what are you talking about? You were adopted. You know, like, there were all these things that he's like, well, I wouldn't call those talents. I said, it doesn't have to be talents. It's your background. It's your story. And there's always somebody who can walk a similar line to you. And it's amazing when you sit down and you're like, okay, like, for example, if you came from an Italian family, I bet you there's somebody who also lives in a very loud family with seven other siblings or something. Like, there are connections you can have to people that go beyond what you would ever think. So just give it a shot. And you guys, I would imagine, are very thorough and very thoughtful in who you pair people with, correct?
Yeah, we try to be very intentional about our matching process and think through what a child's needs are, what their passions and interests are, and how those might align with the adult. And again, your point is really well taken. I mean, there might be a listener of yours who, you know, comes from a family with three or four siblings, and, you know, they used to play a lot of sports together, and that was just part of the environment. Well, if they're matched with a child who also has a bunch of siblings and is dealing with sibling rivalry and so forth, that adult is going to have insights that go beyond what the child brings to the table and can be very helpful to the child. So there are all sorts of assets that people have that they don't necessarily think about until a child is dealing with issues and they realize, oh, I can help with this. And mm-hmm. and that's all that's wanted. And sometimes if you don't have the experience, just having the care and the empathy and the readiness to sit and listen and be supportive and try and think through issues with a young person is all they really need.
Exactly. They want to be heard. They want to know they matter. They want to have value. They want to know that somebody is going to take the time to just hear them out. And it may even be a situation where they've got parents who just work two jobs, or a single parent situation, or whatever it may be. And you're like truly a friend to them, not just a mentor, but you're a friend. You're somebody they look up to and somebody they look to. And it's a very cool opportunity. I think it's very neat. I've always loved Big Brothers Big Sisters. I think the idea is great. I think more people, and what's funny is you go into it, I would imagine, with the thought, oh, I'm helping someone. But I mean, would you argue, Andy, with all of your experience in working with this organization, would you argue that it's amazing what the adults get out of it too?
Yeah, and I really would just quote to you what I hear from so many of our mentors. I'll be at the Big Brothers Big Sisters of the Year event, and I'll be thanking someone who's done amazing things to support their mentee. And the response I get is, I feel like I've gotten far more out of this than Joey or than Jane. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. they're always telling me that they feel like they get more out of it than the child. And you know, I don't know if that's true, but that's how they feel. Because it's just so rewarding. And anyone who's listening who has been a parent or a godparent or an aunt, uncle, grandparent, you know that when you're able to just be supportive of a child and see them develop that greater self-assurance and self-awareness, it's an incredibly rewarding thing. To me, it's one of the most rewarding things there is in life. And so to be able to do that in a way that maybe moves beyond your family and goes and makes someone else in the community, a child who has need, feel like they're part of your family too, it's a really powerful thing.
It really is. It's called Big Brothers Big Sisters of Connecticut, a brand new merger. And the CEO and president, Andy Fleischman, here this morning. Andy, thank you so much for sharing the news on the show and for talking to us about the program. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Melissa. It's really a pleasure to be with you. I've heard great things about your show over the years, and I'm happy now to be reaching out to kids and volunteers in your area to try and ramp up what we do.
Well, thank you, Andy. Appreciate it. And yes, thank you for coming on the show. It's a really cool thing that Big Brothers Big Sisters does. So again, that website is Bigs, B-I-G-S, of CT.org. Bigs of CT.org.
It's time to get out and explore. Melissa in the Morning brings you science you may not know on Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, WICC 600.
Let the record be clear. I do not think my job stinks. I love my job. Before my employers go, wait a minute. This is just a play on words. If you think your job stinks, though, wait till you hear about George Aldrich. David Mestre is here this morning for Science You May Not Know. Who is George Aldrich, David?
George, yeah, George is an incredibly important member of NASA. Yes.
Yes.
And it turns, yes, he's really important. See, it turns out that that he's actually NASA's chief sniffer.
What do you mean a sniff? Like smelling?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yes.
What do you need, what do you need to sniff? What?
Everything. Everything has to be sniffed.
Everything to smell. What? I don't even understand this
yeah,
concept.
So this, it's incredible. So here's the deal. The deal is that, you know, NASA wants to make sure that everything that is within the environment, enclosed environment of a spacecraft, exposed to astronauts, has to be safe.
Okay.
And so, you know, out in White Sands, New Mexico, they have what's called the White Sands Test Facility. And this is the home of the Materials Flight Acceptance Workforce. This is the thing. Yeah.
That's something. I'm just a
They've got a job
host.
To do.
Jeez.
And so their job is to test everything that actually gets into space. And
okay.
So they test flammability tests. They've got toxicity tests. But they also have odor tests.
Interesting. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what happens is that, you know, they've got a team of people that actually has to test odor, because if something stinks, you know, there really isn't any place to run. And if it's in a spacecraft, you just can't open up a window and
clear it out. You got to figure out what's making it. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And so we want the astronauts to be focused on the mission, not focused on the odor. And so they've got a team of guys, a team of people, and their job is to actually sniff things. And they've got a name. The name is, they are the odor panel.
Can you imagine having that on your resume? Yeah, I worked on the odor panel.
I am on the odor panel.
That's pretty nuts.
And there's one member of the odor panel that is by far the most experienced sniffer NASA has, and that is George Aldrich. He is the veritable Nostradamus. Of NASA.
I mean,
he's been doing this sniffing for NASA for 48 years.
Shut it down. Are you
48
serious?
Years. Yes, yes. He was actually
48 years. Yes,
he was
NASA?
Sniffing for NASA 48 years. Now, this is amazing.
What?
So
this
is incredible. Yeah, 48 years. 48 years. To be on the odor panel, no, you've got to keep your nose in top shape.
You've got to have
an absolutely clean nose. And so what happens is that, you know, before you actually start sniffing, you actually have to go through a medical clearance.
How do you even, like end up on the odor panel? You have to be qualified.
Yes, you have to be pre-qualified by a nose and throat physical medical professional.
Okay.
So that you actually have to be physically qualified to actually be on the nose on the odor panel.
Oh my gosh, this is insane.
Yeah. Yeah, and then they have what's called the 10 bottle test. Okay, you have to pass the 10
bottles.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you've got the 10 bottles now. Now 7 of the bottles, well, they have distinctive odors, and 3 of them are supposed to be odor-free.
Okay.
And so you have to be able to pick out the odor-free bottles, and then you have to be able to identify accurately each of the odors that are in the 7 bottles.
Oh, no, I'd be so bad at this. Unless I was pregnant.
Yep.
So they've got seven scents.
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. So you have the 7 scents. One of the bottles has musky.
Mm.
Yeah, there's minty.
Okay, I'm cool with that.
Floral.
Love that.
Uh-huh. Ethereus. Mm. I don't know what that is.
Mysterious.
Yeah, ethereus, mysterious. Camphoraceous.
What in the world is that?
I know, yeah. Gosh. Pungent.
Oh, God, pungent, no.
Yep,
and putrid,
and the one you
gotta, worst.
Ugh. Yep, yep. And putrid.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yes, and you have to go through this test every 4 months to stay on the odor panel. So this guy has been going through this odor test every 4 months for 48 years.
I gotta. So we're talking about heat. So every 4 months would mean he takes it three times a year.
Yep.
Oh my gosh, this
gotta
guy
go through this
144
test.
Times he's taken this test.
This test, exactly. Just
Man.
To stay on the odor panel. This guy's a real trooper. Now he knows.
His nose is a trooper. Good Lord.
He knows that this is an important job, and in fact, because of his work, he has actually received the very prestigious Silver Snoopy Award.
That's an award?
That is, yes. Yeah, only
Silver
1%
Snoopy.
Of NASA workers will ever get. This is actually an award. This is really kind of serious. It turns out this is an award that astronauts will give NASA workers for helping them do their job.
Wait, that's really cool. I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yes. And so when astronauts found out that this guy's been sniffing for 48 years.
So, like, you should give it to this guy.
That this dude has been such a trooper, making sure that stinky things don't end up in our spacecraft, that they were like, done. Where's the application I need to fill out to give this guy the Silver Snoopy?
When did he get it? Recently? Or
You know what? I got to figure that. I think it was probably about probably a decade ago or something like that. Yeah, he's been sniffing for a long time. Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, but it's an important job. Yeah, because, you know, and in fact, you know, up here in Connecticut, you know, we've got, a technology company that actually works on building the commodes for the spacecrafts.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's a very important job. Yeah, exactly. And so they've actually had to test them down at White Sands to make sure that after they've been used,
you can't smell anything.
You can't smell anything.
Wow.
You know,
the only thing I find really surprising, David, is we have, like, drug-sniffing dogs and bomb-sniffing dogs. I'm surprised that NASA – not that I – listen – I think it's amazing if you could be on the odor panel. That's very, very cool. But I'm surprised that they don't, like, use dogs.
Yeah, that's a
I'm
good
surprised.
Question. So one of the things that a dog can't do is it can't, like, quantify the smell.
Oh,
and so
I see what you're saying. Like, they can't identify what they're –
Yeah, yeah. So for example, like, you know, like, one of the things that they'll do with the smell test is they have a ranking system of, like, 0 to 4. Like,
mm-hmm.
0 is, like, I don't smell anything. To, like, 4, this thing is, like, rancid. This is, like – bad.
Wow.
And so
a dog
with that,
couldn't tell you that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. A dog can say, oh, I smell something, but they can't say, you know, this is like a putrid smell, or, oh, you know, I have this kind of pungent butterscotch kind of, you know. So this guy has, like, trained his nose to be able to pick up, like, really fine things in the scent.
That's nuts.
Yeah. And so sometimes when a new piece of equipment is tested, he may actually take a sniff and say, it's not working right. Something's not operating. Yeah, not operating properly.
I'd be so insecure to have this guy to my house. I feel like he'd walk in and be like, I smell dogs. I smell toddlers potty training. Like I can fake everything with a Yankee candle, but I couldn't get past this guy.
Not Nostradamus.
I'm not inviting him over anytime soon.
He can pick through everything. Yeah.
I'm a little insecure now. David, what an interesting topic. I tell ya, nothing gets past you.
I think these are, some people don't realize, you know, the lengths that NASA goes through to make sure that astronauts can meet this mission. Because it's, you know, because one thing that happens is that, you know, when you're in the International Space Station, the new astronauts that show up for the first time on board, they're not used to the smells.
It's all new.
It's all new, but it's also, you know, like they're, it actually kind of stinks up there. It, you know, because you got a lot of people they can't shower. So you kind of have a little BO that's up there, BO.
Yeah.
And what also happens is that if it's something really stinky and you know, astronauts and human beings, we do this. We actually go into this olfactory fatigue. We just kind of get used to it.
Yeah. We kind of go into autopilot.
Interesting. And so our astronauts' nose is actually really important because they can sense when something's not operating properly or if there's an outgassing of some type, and that could be very important for their safety too. So those are things that we want to make sure that everything that gets up there, you know, is as smell-free as possible. And in fact, like, one of the worst smelling things that almost ended up in space was Velcro.
It just gives me such a whole new perspective on what our astronauts
NASA will go through. Make sure.
Listen, they take
our
it
mission
seriously.
Is yeah. we meet the mission.
Yeah.
We do this.
Wow. David Mestre, I tell you, every week you just introduce me to a whole new world of stuff. Thank you so much. Appreciate
you're
it.
so welcome. Send a card to George Aldrich. Just let him know that we're thinking about him, and he's a trooper.
Yeah, maybe I will. I'll smell you later. That sounds good.
I'll smell you later.
Sounds good. David Mestre, thank you so much.